La selección china de personas que presentan al mundo la antorcha olímpica se ha transformado en una lección de derechos humanos para la Unión Americana. Beatriz Salas amplía la información.
Decidir sobre quiénes serán los portadores de la antorcha en la ceremonia inaugural de los Juegos Olímpicos de Invierno en Pekín es la responsabilidad de China, y Estados Unidos no está en posición de hacer comentarios despectivos. Así respondió Pekín a la reciente interferencia de Washington, quien aseveró que la elección de China del atleta de la etnia Uyghur de Nijir Jilamujian para llevar la antorcha olímpica es un esfuerzo de Pekín para distraer la atención del llamado genocidio en la región de Xinjiang.
Los llamados comentarios de genocidio de Estados Unidos son la gran mentira del siglo y exponen su intento de politizar los Juegos Olímpicos de Invierno y su siniestra intención de utilizar el tema relacionado con Xinjiang para difamar a China.
China asimismo acusó a Estados Unidos de mentir de manera descarada sobre las minorías étnicas, mientras olvida sistemáticamente discriminaciones en su propio suelo.
Estados Unidos llevó a cabo un genocidio contra los nativos americanos en el pasado y ha discriminado sistemáticamente a las minorías raciales a largo plazo. La población de nativos americanos se ha desplomado de 5 millones a finales del siglo XV a unos 250 mil a principios del siglo XX, reduciéndose a una vigésima parte. ¿Qué es el genocidio? Las políticas que Estados Unidos ha impuesto a los nativos americanos son un verdadero genocidio.
Zhao, además de criticar la discriminación racial contra los africanos y asiáticos en Estados Unidos, dijo que elegir a un atleta de la etnia Uyghur muestra que la política de China de promover los deportes de invierno y mejorar la salud de las personas está beneficiando a individuos de todos los grupos étnicos y prueba que no existe discriminación.
Lo que Estados Unidos debería estar haciendo es revisar cuidadosamente sus propios crímenes históricos contra los nativos americanos y tomar medidas concretas para reducir la discriminación racial contra estas personas y otras minorías raciales, como los africanos y asiáticos.
China, en reiteradas ocasiones, ha instado a Estados Unidos a dejar de usar los asuntos vinculados con Xinjiang para difundir mentiras, interferir en los asuntos internos de China o intentar detener el desarrollo del país. Advierte que, de lo contrario, Pekín dará una respuesta más contundente a la luz del desarrollo de la situación. Beatriz Salas con información de Niloufar Shakuri, Hispan TV Noticias.
Migrantes de todos los rincones del mundo duermen bajo su mismo cielo estrellado. Me los encuentro en las calles, en los cines, en los supermercados, y el olor de sus comidas me embriaga de placer. Todos ellos son mis vecinos.
Y yo aquí vivo, bajo sus leyes domésticas, pago impuestos y mis manos producen la riqueza nacional.
Soy parte de esa comunidad que vive, trabaja y sueña con una mañana mejor para nuestras familias.
Casi todos migrantes como yo, casi todos soñadores como yo.
Trabajemos pues en la construcción de otra nación que nos haga dignos.
Seamos los arquitectos de nuestro sueño colectivo.
Esta radio no tiene comerciales porque tú nos apoyas. Si ya has hecho una aportación económica, te damos las gracias. Si no, hazlo ahora en kpfk.org o llama al 818-985-5735.
Así llegamos al final de esta edición del Informativo Pacífica. Nuestro más profundo agradecimiento a todos los medios y personas que hicieron posible este programa. A nombre de Norma Martínez, se despide tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Velázquez. Gracias por acompañarnos.
Este y otros programas del Informativo Pacífica pueden ser escuchados o descargados en iPod o en forma tradicional en www.kpfk.org en los archivos de audio.
Told me, you know, we'll give you a day, we'll give you a week, however long it takes for you to accept our help to be healed and to become a child of God and denounce being gay.
Honoring the memory of Dr. Anonymous, coming up on the Rainbow Minute.
got three quarters of the way through several times and was like, well, I have no idea how this would end, so I have to start over. But one thing I know is I can't end a story without hope.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Nicaragua's NGO Purge targets its oldest queer group. Gay Taiwanese movie sings out a universal love song and upending the artistic process with Amanda Kayback. All that and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Joe Bainline.
And I'm John Dyer V.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending August 28, 2021. The government of Nicaragua is aiming to shut down the country's oldest LGBTQ advocacy group. The Interior Ministry has asked the National Assembly to annul the legal nonprofit status of Fundación Xaquiquetzal and 14 other non-governmental organizations. President.
Middle of the summer, midnight. Sitting in a crowded apartment, about 110 degrees. I went outside the middle of the night. All I had was a match in my hand. I wanted to fight, so I said, burn, baby, burn. Secretary said it wasn't now. I tried to get in touch with Mr. Humphrey. He couldn't find him anywhere. I went into the courtroom with my poor black feet. Didn't have no money, didn't have no lawyer. They wouldn't plead my case. So I said, burn, baby, burn. Job now. All I had was a mat. Couldn't get oil from a Rockefeller well. Couldn't get the diamonds from the mine. I can't enjoy the American dream. Won't be water but the fire next time. So I said, burn, baby, burn. Burn, baby, burn. Nowhere to be, Lord, and nowhere.
son. I really want a decent job now. I really want a decent opportunity. I want to grow like everybody else. I want to grow like everybody else. I want to grow like everybody else. I want to grow like everybody else.
As soon as you're born, they make you feel small by giving you no time instead of it all. Till the pain is so big you feel nothing at all. A working class hero is something to be. Working class hero is something to be. They hurt you at home and they hit you at school. They hate you if you're clever and they despise a fool. Till you're so fucking crazy you can't follow their rules. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. When they tortured and scared you for 20 odd years, then they expect you to pick a career. When you can't really function, you're so full of fear. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. Keep you doped with religion and sex and TV. And you think you're so clever and classless and free, but you're still fucking peasants as far as I can see. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. There's room at the top, they are telling you still. But first you must learn how to smile as you kill. If you want to be like the folks on the hill. A working class hero is something to be.
sunani 66 ki baatein purani aao ab likhe hum nayi si ek kahani world cup hamara hai beckham ka sahara hai kismat ka ishara hai jeet le hum khelo josh mein khelo germany se world cup le lo aao dikhaye jeet ke hum khelo khelo josh mein khelo germany se world cup le lo aao dikhaye jeet ke hum mauka na gawana humko na rulana tum par hai bharosa baazi jeet lana world cup hamara hai beckham ka sahara hai kismat ka ishara hai jeet le hum khelo khelo josh mein khelo germany se world cup le lo aao dikhaye jeet ke hum khelo khelo josh mein khelo germany se world cup le lo aao dikhaye jeet ke hum
just cheer on now we ship the ball in
Model goal, Wild Street, not total goal, Daddy Ferdinand, got a chunk of sand, Wally's the man with the safest hands, Germany, France, Bochkirena, Italy, Brazil, Bochkirena, Argentina, Bochkirena, we're on the way, the English stand up.
So you can't see this very hour come and go with me. Death, I come to take the soul, leave the body and leave it cold. To drop the flesh off of the frame, the earth and worm both have a claim. Oh, death. Oh, death, won't you spare me over till another year? My mother came to my bed, placed a cold towel upon my head. My head is warm, my feet are cold, death is a-moving upon my soul. Oh, death, how you treating me? You close my eyes so I can't see. Well, you're hurting my body. You make me cold. You run my life right out of my soul. Oh, death, please consider my age. Please don't take me at this stage. My wealth is all at your command, if you will move your icy hands. Oh, the young, the rich or poor, all alike me, you know. No wealth, no land, no silver, no gold, nothing satisfies me but your soul. Oh, death. Oh, damn, won't you spare me over till another year? Won't you spare me over till another year? Won't you spare me over till another year?
Present a man now who knows his lesson. Evan Ross Abernathy.
And all we've got to do is to keep marching. Do tomorrow what we did today. And do it the next day. And then the next day we won't have to do it at all. Because yesterday we filled, day before yesterday we filled up the jails. And then today we filled up the jail yard. And on tomorrow, when they look up and see that number coming, I don't know what they're going to do.
To all my heavy hustling, struggling, revolutionary, gang banging, chain ganging, tune your frequency. I refuse to be a stereotype in your box. Never wanna try to be something I'm not. I'm just a nigga from the block. If you got it twisted, stay blowing on green. If you got it twisted on up, DP's giving.
even a buck. RBG'd up and some gangster chunks. Throw your fist up, homie, if you know what's up. All my comrades putting in soldier work. We rolling dirty with it, fully dedicated. So real that the radio and never play it. But that's cool, the enemy's supposed to hate it. Freedom ain't gonna come till we regulate them. That's why I'm in the dojo, not just for the video. Really though, we really got beef with the bobo. Never know when they gonna put you in a chokehold. This is for you new niggas hoeing for the radio.
Turn off the radio. Turn off that bullshit. Turn off the radio. Turn off that bullshit. Turn off the radio. Turn off that bullshit. Turn off the radio.
People's Radio.
Yo, hang up. That's police.
What's on the radio? Propaganda, mind control, and turning it on. It's like putting on the blindfold. Cause when you bring in the real, you don't get rotation. Let you take over the station. And yeah, I know it's part of their plans to make us think it's all about party and dancing. Yo, it might sound good when you spin your rap, but in reality, don't nobody live like that. You wanna know what kind of nigga I am? Let me tell you about the nigga I'm not. I don't fuck with the cops. Platinum don't mean that it gotta be hot. I ain't gotta.
Free Radio Santa Cruz broadcast or netcast of Bathurst Pier's broadsides the April 21st, 2022 Thursday show. Going to be following largely a long interview with activist Brent Adams of the Footbridge Services domain over there on Felker Street. And also we're going to look into the last city council meeting, or the shitty city council, as I like to call them, or feel actually impelled to call them, regarding the issue of new restrictions being proposed on public meetings, or I should say rather public protest demonstrations and gatherings, which actually passed with a first reading and is coming back this coming Tuesday on the 26th, so watch out. And here we go.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
So here we go with this conversation I had a few days ago with Brent Adams. Backstory Brent, as I've recently taken to calling him, because he fills in some of the details of some things that I'm unaware of often, although we often have differences of opinion. And that was the case in this conversation as well. So now you're going to be privy to it. So the conversation actually begins with me wandering about Brent's offices at 150 Felker Street, Suite H, I think it is, which is open from 8 to 10 in the morning, and I guess it's 5 to 7 in the evenings for various services, shelter mostly, storage, but it's also got some other options as well. In any case, here we go. April 19th. About 20 to 2, comes to Footbridge Services Center. Checking out a list of homeless resources on the wall. The motto is, let's keep ourselves and each other safe. No public restroom. Please address bathroom needs prior to arriving. And there's a list of homeless resources. Not sure how much I would agree with this, but I'm going to hopefully grab a copy, although the list of homeless services, which is available, usually apparently it says take one, is not operational. There's a list of times for syringe services. Cool.
Thank you.
I'm now in Brent's office, which is comfortable, a nice-looking red rug, and a video which Brent has just done and posted. Where is it posted, Brent?
YouTube. It's Step Comandante. It'll be on Facebook on Warming Center's page, We Are Santa Cruz. You'll find it on some of, and on Joe Williams, The Crucible?
Likely be on The Crucible if you go to a Facebook page. Maybe Footbridge Services? Maybe not. I don't know. And, but anyway, we have the real live Brent here, although you'll be just hearing him on audio, who's surveyed the Good Times article recently in the April 14th Good Times by a would-be or actually ongoing city council member and a potential, God help us, supervisor. She's running for supervisor. I don't know how to pronounce her first name. Maybe you do.
Shebra
Kalantari Johnson. Thank you. Thank you, Brent. And it's really largely a puff piece, sort of a letter that talks about all the wonderful things the city council has done, namely the ordinances criminalizing homelessness.
I'm talking about the Sentinel article. But,
right. Good point. Actually, Brent is talking about the Sentinel article by Jessica York, which I read this morning online. It actually simply reiterates what I've been saying for the last 2 months, and perhaps what you've also been saying in your interviews, Brent, though I don't remember the specifics, some of it, which is to say it's sort of a loudspeakers, Matt Huffaker, the city manager's comments. It has no comments from homeless activists, service people, or actual human beings who actually are living a life outdoors. And, Brent, what are your thoughts about it? Let me catch you here.
All right. We're talking about this. So, for me, the article is titled, ominously, Santa Cruz sets end date for largest homeless camp. And we take
Benchlands.
The Benchlands in the San Lorenzo Park. Now, the funny thing about that is they've closed so many areas, right? Hell's Trail, Camp Paradise, the entirety of the levee, the highway camps, right?
Poganip.
So,
Earl Street.
Yeah, and so all these people are, or anywhere else, anywhere people have been, they've been directed to go to the Benchlands. And there's a long story to talk about there. You know, we probably won't get to that. But so that's the allowable space. Disallowing agreement camps anywhere else, and the I never know what it's called, but the Santa Cruz New Homelessness Plan indicates that they're going to have 150 bed spaces, shelter spaces, camp spaces, but the Benchlands is there, and it's summertime, springtime, so we think it could go on for quite a while without threat of river water rise, but the I don't know what I'm answering here, but the it says sets an end date for the largest homeless camp. So that's the interesting thing that they're saying, that they're going to be starting that in the, by the end of April. That's within weeks from now, right?
Well, he said by the end of July.
Oh, okay.
Is what he said. But he uses the language that Susie O'Hara used to use, which is we are aiming for, we are aspiring to, our hopes are, we expect that there will be.
You say he. We're talking about Matt Huffaker?
Correct.
Yeah, so he's the... I appreciate that they went all the way up to the top of the totem here, right? It's not a fig. It's not one of these people that they hire. It's not Lee Butler. It's not Larry and Wally or whoever else. It's, you know, the buck stops here guy. And I think that's most appropriate, finally. I don't see what... So what I did was just go all the way down to the bottom here where it says reaching the need. And this is where it says 10 of the 75 program spaces will be held in reserve for night-only beds. And that is so that they can enforce a no-camping ordinance and say that there is frequently or always some level of availability.
To get around Martin versus Boise.
Yeah, so they're going to keep 10 spots open so they can point to those and say, oh, we have availability.
And these are just service-resistant people.
Right, and it even says that here. those who want shelter, what is it?
Not said? All individuals who want to stay in shelters or manage camps.
Yeah. So where do we get that information or data? That's ridiculous. As we know, when we opened Warming Center in Watsonville and Santa Cruz, if you do a little bit of street outreach, people will come. And this is what we learned from Julie Conway years ago, Robert. They would always say, no, there's shelter capacity available in Watsonville. I'm like, how can that be? This is before the new Salvation Army shelter. So they had Teen Challenge had a shelter with a few beds. And they would always indicate that there's a space. We're like, if there's so many people in the downtown core in Watsonville and along the Pajaro, how can you say that there's... So we realized that they weren't doing any outreach in Santa Cruz, in Watsonville. So just by doing a little outreach in Santa Cruz, we were able to, you know, balloon this Warming Center concept. So that's what we believe they're going to do here. Hold these 10 beds available, and they're not going to be able to populate them on the regular. They're going to kick those 10 people out every morning to reopen those 10 beds and always point to those beds so that they can do what? Enforce the no camping ordinance. So the entire thing, yes, they said they're going to put people on the pathway to housing, right? Yes, they said they're going to put, offer services, but largely, it even says this somewhere in the article, they'll be funding the police department to enforce this. A lot of that funding is going to go to housing matters for various service orientation. The Salvation Army is going to get some. The transitional camp is going to get some, and then they're going to build another one.
That's the 1220 River Street.
Yeah, right.
Which you feel is improperly named.
Oh, yeah. Well, and it's a bummer because we were trying to institute a non-profit or church oriented, like the operated program, that a mission-oriented nonprofit is more appropriate to run a homeless program than a city, than city staff, because they don't really have that mission, that humanitarian element. It's debatable, but we think that's what the nonprofit sector is for. The city shouldn't be running camps and programs. You allow others to do that, and you fund those, and you create the parameters by which to do that. They're way more efficient and way more effective. So this transitional camp up at 1220 Street, River Street, hasn't been, well, you know, that's another conversation.
Right. What I've heard from those close to the camp is that very few people have done any transitioning. Very few transitioned in the previous incarnations of 1220 River.
Yeah.
And I think the main point that you are making in terms of the model you've suggested, it's not just that the nonprofit would run it. There would be certain kinds of structures there that you feel would be most likely to make it successful.
Yeah, part of that is empowering individuals in the camp and have them be a function of their own healing, also holding each other accountable, community meeting, and so having an engagement and also bringing the community at large in. Rather than, we saw Matt Huffaker and Larry M. Wally literally say that it's being successful so far because they all have housing vouchers, which is a travesty. As we know, they just released more than 200 new vouchers without opening a single new room for rent, right? So we have way more people fighting over non-existent housing than ever. So many people are now like, hey, I got it. I got my housing. I'm like, you got it? No, I got a voucher. I'm like, oh no. How hard it is to take one of those vouchers and get an actual space now.
I heard something similar, yeah.
It's real frightening. We know that the all-in plan, the entire permanent supported housing plan within Santa Cruz, is that they're not building it out for us, but we're expected to open up our bedrooms, and it's called the rehousing wave from the county. It's called Housing Now at Housing Matters. There's a bonus, $1,000 to $2,000 bonus for the homeowner to rent to somebody. Almost nobody's taking the bait. Almost nobody's in this program.
Do you have any stats on that? Or?
Yeah, you could go back 6 months ago and 3 months ago. The article is written by the Sentinel, where the point person, his name is Robert Ratner from the county, is saying it's actually not successful at all. They have to readjust their numbers, meaning totally scale back their intention. What they do is keep doubling down on something that's broken, rather than saying, hey, we have a nonprofit sector here. We have a lot of community members who would like to be involved, and we may disagree. Let me just say this really quickly. What we're seeing in the bench lens is not exactly a homelessness problem. It's also a substance use challenge because we have so many dealers down there. It's across from the jail. And a lot of people, when we see when the Camp Paradise, and this might be their thinking, when the Camp Paradise and Hell's Trail spaces close or the river rises, you'll see about a third of the people just disappear. And they go back to housing. They go back home. And that might be some of the thinking here. If you take 300, 400 people, you cut it in half, maybe that's the people they think they're going to be dealing with. And they probably think they have a manageable plan here, but it's not appropriate to do to this population of people outside. The whole thing was that $14 million, I thought, from the state, as triggered by John Laird, was for services, was to deal with the emergency nature, not to find a way to criminalize. But we knew, we've been seeing this all along, the catch was really just a way to figure out.
Catch is the community, the group, I'm not sure what the name of it is, but it's the group that sat for a year, which had very few homeless people in it, and mostly, it looked like, I don't know if we can say it's residue from the task force that they set up in 2013 that Rene Golder was a part of, you may remember that, which essentially was a criminalize, or at least do something about these visible homeless people.
Well, when you have Susie O'Hara, what was the man's name?
Scott Collins?
No. The big guy from the state in there. He's a famous, the biggest guy we have in Santa Cruz. He lives here. He lives on Market Street. He was officiating the catch meetings. Oh, I can't remember his name. But you had
Andy Schifrin?
No. Bigger than that. He's actually working with the state assembly.
John Laird?
No, the other guy. Oh, Jesus, this is terrible. I feel embarrassed.
Mark Stone?
No. He's with...
Your point is...
So it was a city government function, and they were... It was just a what do you call it? It wasn't really a citizens program. Well, this is another conversation we're having here, but it looked more like the city council was... feeding them information, running the show.
This is the 2013 task force you're talking about.
No,
or the catch.
Catch
committee
anyway,
from a couple of years ago.
So what we believe that they're doing since March in versus Boise is trying to, and the city manager and city attorney spoke at the vets hall early on in the catch meetings about how they're going to be able to get this new ordinance on board. And this whole homeless program is really just a function to try to get them to be able to do what they need to do. And here, Emperor Wear No Clothes, Cassie Bronson from the city attorney's office says they just need to be able to point to these 10 beds. It all comes down to these 10 beds, finally, in my opinion.
I'm wondering if that's going to work, but...
Yeah,
in terms of with the courts, that's the question.
Well, I mean, luckily you've got the sex. We're riding under the success of the Homeless Union. I don't know if they're still together in a way to address these issues, and ACLU, but those are the only functions in, you know...
Disability Rights Coalition.
Yeah, Santa Cruz Cares has brought something against the city also about the...
Meisler, yeah.
Right. So, you know, power to the people. That's the only thing we've got. The city owns this space. They can do whatever the hell they want to, and they do until we can bring in the court. So
this space meaning
the city, the county, the world, the country. You know, it
has the power to do what it wants with
them. Yeah. All these, you know, the Bill of Rights and the Constitution are a freedom cage. You know, we don't have true freedom, and we don't have, you and I can't serve people who sleep outside in the way that we want to. Food Not Bombs can't. We understand, and even our organization can't. When we want to stage an agreement camp in a city,
Footbridge Services.
Well, Warming Center wants to do an agreement camp. They say they'll arrest people, even though it's been vastly successful in all these spaces. So,
about Eugene and other places.
No, I'm saying Harvey West and Camp. Harvey West was extremely successful agreement camp. They've never been done anywhere else, which is just simply saying that, you know, it's not a managed space. That's another conversation yet also. But why would they allow these huge crime-oriented dumping ground camps to proliferate and not allow others to host an encampment?
I think, one, they're cheap. You don't have to spend very much other than, you know, fund two people, Jeremy Leonard and Chris.
Oh, no. We're talking about agreement camps. It's totally different. Agreement camp is where the... It's not even a transitional camp.
No, I'm talking about the benchlands. Why are they doing it, dumping it in the benchlands? Yeah. Well, one, because they have to have somewhere to dump it, because they don't want people to appear on the streets. And also, frankly, I am suspicious that in spite of their claim that they're going to shut this down in July, they will have no place to go, because they have provided no new spaces over the last 9 months. They've already talked about, you know, opening up of the armory area and the, what do they call it, the Gulflands.
Yeah, I think that's open now. I think they have that's fully active.
Open, I think for partially open at least, and they've talked about they opened up 1220 for 30 tents. But aside from that, they don't have anything else. So we're going to take a brief musical break, but we'll be back with this exchange very soon.
When I came out of my mama, they cut my umbilical cord. I thought, hey man, what are you doing? And I let out a mighty roar. I got my first piercing when they stabbed me with a pin. Pumped me full of something and hit me in the shin. Ever since that moment, I've just been full of scorn. I've been a punk rock baby since the day that I was born. I got my first mohawk at the age of one. Stole my old man's razor, and then the job was done. I got a leather jacket at the age of two. Put spikes all over it with some super glue. I started scratching at my pants until they were all torn. I've been a punk rock baby since the day that I was born. I got my first electric guitar at the age of three. Turned the volume up just as high as it could be. I yelled into the mic about all the things I felt about this nasty world and the cards we'd all been dealt. About the toxic sludge that made me angry and forlorn. I've been a punk rock baby since the day that I was born. Nursery school at the age of four. I said, hey, this place is boring. I am going out the door. I headed straight downtown, sat down in the park, met some other punks, stayed out till way past dark, partied till the dawn, came back home in the morning. Rock baby since the day that I was born. I moved into a squat at the age of five. Behind the barricades I waited for the cops to arrive. I climbed onto the roof and said, here's where I'm gonna stay, and I'm gonna be a rebel until I'm old and gray. Between the toes of your establishment, I'll always be a thorn. I've been a punk rock baby since the day that I was born. I've been a punk rock baby since the day that I was born.
And that's a cut from the House Concert for the Web that Rovix, looks like he fairly recently did it. Now back to Brent Adams and me.
probably going to open another transitional camp someplace else.
They said that.
So I think, given the benefit of the doubt, they have the ability
but
to do that.
For 400 people. Unless
No. They only have to do 150. And they're going to do 150. Point to those 10 beds.
Because of the law. But I'm talking about the reality.
Oh, the law is their ordinance, right?
Right. Okay, that's what I'm saying.
All right. So the deal is, this is what I believe is going to happen. You'll have 300 people out there and with no place to go, and they're going to point to those 10 empty beds saying, we can criminalize you, we can write a citation. And then it'll be, you know, an accumulation of these tickets, and then finally ACLU or some other entity will bring the larger action against the city finally. And that's probably next year or the year after that. Probably 2 years from now we'll be seeing that.
But, you know, it's an interesting question, because even if they 150 people do get into these places minus the 10, you say, there'll be 150 or more, I would say a lot more than 150, that are outside in different places. Many of them, of course, may go to the Poganip, attempt to hide in various places, or be ignored by the police. But we have found generally, because of the rent situation, which I don't think has really markedly improved, I don't have any sense of new stats here, but, you know, I mean, Keith McHenry is always saying that, you know, this is a rental crisis, we're in the middle of a catastrophe. And I think there's some truth to that, although I don't have the stats in Santa Cruz to show what's actually happening here. But there are going to be more people hitting the streets, and what they do in these times is they throw people into, well, they've done in the past, is they've thrown people into the benchlands again.
Yeah, right.
And the situation for the benchlands, remember, was they made a deal with the courts that they would set up 120 spaces so that people, and it would be managed and it would be carefully controlled. Not that I'm a fan of any of this necessarily. You may be to some extent in some ways. But in any case, that was never done.
No, it could have been an agreement camp. The a part of it was, I believe you could have a camp like that, pardon me, that you section up into thirds. If it's 150, you need pods of 50 or no more of people who can take care of their own spaces, meaning they have each other's back. They know who's in their space. They don't let people into each other's tents. The biggest problem that we have are the extreme desperation that people have, people stealing from each other, and then coercion. You have a lot of violence in these spaces. Right now, go down there now. You have all these guys walking around with black eyes. Have you noticed that?
No, I haven't.
There's a new dealing crew. They call them paisas, right? They're people, Mexicans, they're people from El Salvador. They're largely gangs, MS-13, and people, Sureños from Watsonville. And they're running the game down here. And it's extremely aggressive. But it's an economic engine, because probably 95% of the people in the benchlands right now are using substances that they need to access every single day. So that's a lot of money moving through the benchlands.
How much time have you been spending down there?
I'm there a little bit every day, probably once a week. I'm there about an hour.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Again, as I said, again, to follow up what I was saying before, when the courts set this up as a way of kind of doing a halfway deal with the Union of the Homeless back in March of last year, the deal was that there would be it would be for 120 spaces, and I think the city wanted it to be controlled and limited on the theory that they could, this could be a temporary thing, and then they could sort of magically wave their hands, it would all disappear in a few months, once the COVID crisis was over. But the fact is that they can't really do that, because there are so many more people, first of all. And so their immediate response was, let's just start throwing people into the benchlands. And the benchlands actually, you know, it generated its own, it's had its own momentum. I mean, although a lot of people, as you, I'm sure you've noticed, because you are right next to what was the Hell's Trail and the Camp Paradise area, don't want to go to the benchlands. They feel, for I think sometimes justified, sometimes unjustified reasons, that they're scared of it. You know, and so that being the case, there's a lot more camping outside the benchlands, even though the benchlands is huge now, than in the benchlands. What's your experience recently regarding encampments outside the benchlands? How's that going? What kind of input do you get on that?
We know that there are a few people scattered around the west side. We know Arana Gulch zone area, but they clean that up quite regularly, North Harbor. I shouldn't be naming all these places, Emmeline Zone has quite a few people up there. And then the Poganip and...
If you want, you can...
Sycamore Grove has been... Everyone's been notified to clear out of there. And the only place they indicate is go to the benchlands. Mm-hmm. And we have... there's new people hitting Santa Cruz all the time now. And they go to the Benchlands, and there's still room for probably 50 more people in the Benchlands to cram in there. They're finally filling in the middle area. I don't know if you noticed that. They're finally out. They're up on the ridge. There are two or three layers at the on the west side, and now they're moving towards the middle. So it's a little frightening, I would say. They turn the water off every other day because the ground gets oversaturated and starts pooling up. So they turn the water off. There's electricity available down there, but it turns off at on a whim, sometimes at 2 p.m., sometimes at 3. Doesn't last all day.
You bring showers down there once?
Yeah, with the Association of Faith Communities on Friday between 10 and 2, we host showers. We're doing about 40 showers. The county is saying they would like us to do another day, but they've not talked to us. They talked to Association of Faith Communities. I don't know what to say about all that. I think we could have done it vastly different and better, but there's no invitation for the community. And also, the community is split in so many ways that we don't play well with each other. Even the people who are politically aligned have so many disagreements about. But we agree. The way I would say it is, almost nobody thinks people should be able to camp freely in every corner of Santa Cruz and shanty up. Very few people think they should be moved wholesale from Santa Cruz and without a tent seen anywhere. Most of us are someplace in the middle. And the question is, where's that conversation about how we would coexist with this challenge? How would nonprofits be encouraged, and church groups and community members? There's all these new community groups that would love the opportunity to shepherd a homeless encampment, meaning a transitional camp. We don't have a permit process. They didn't allow a storage program like ours to be part of the conversation, even though we think they're building their own storage program. They've shut us out completely from the conversation.
Well, I think they've shut out the idea of...
And Association of Faith Communities also. They feel shut out of the conversation.
But they're getting a large appropriation.
For the safe parking, yeah. And the joke is they keep calling out the safe parking, this and that, and taking credit for it. But the leaders of Association of Faith Communities say they almost never talk with them.
Now, do we know how successful or unsuccessful, what kind of problems or success they've had, the safe parking?
No, I haven't been following it. I don't even know where they are. I don't know. I think they can have as many as 5 vehicles in a single location. I haven't heard any reports at all.
Yeah, I'm having trouble. When you try to find out, some of the people who were working for the program just quit because they felt they couldn't get good information that they could pass on to people.
His name is Father Jacobs, I think, or...
Jacobson or something?
Yeah, you should contact him.
I've tried.
And we don't even know who's chairing the...
I remember the conversation we had, 3 years ago in Loudoun Nelson, 2 years ago, when you and I were in the room. We were talking, and Jacobs... My apologies to him for getting his name mangled here. But we asked some really serious questions about, you know, why was this campground closed at the edge of town? Remember on the county, you know, that we hoped it would be open. And he became very defensive and very concerned. I mean, you may not remember this.
I wasn't there.
I thought you were.
No, I've never met him in person.
Huh.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay.
I mean, he's not part of... That's the weird thing. You know, Housing Matters isn't part of the conversation. I don't think they go anywhere near the Benchlands themselves. You know, they don't have any... That's the weird thing about the world these days. It's there's the reality of the situation and people really trying to help on the ground. Then you have the large money programs and the people who have access to the conversation with the city and the county. And there's a hard wall between the two. And it almost seems like they're insecure about adding more people to what they call, quote unquote, city or county partners. Here we are year after year over here doing all these services. We have a women's shelter on the property. Again,
you wanted to say that, or would you?
Yeah, yeah. We have a women's shelter nearby, 11 beds, incredibly successful, all volunteer. It's never been done. I would like to see anybody in the country indicate that they've done it in the way that we've done it. We build community around our concepts and empower the people within the spaces. That's what we would like to see in a transitional camp. There's so much to talk about on these issues. But what we're talking about today is what's up. You know, we haven't even discussed Shebra Kalantari-Johnson's letter in the Good Times, where she's kind of like the public relations firm for the city's move, mm-hmm. right? It's all kind of smoke and there's nothing, no real there, but we're all supposed to feel good about it. Mm-hmm. And that's what she's done there. And that's why, you know, I, as a nonprofit organization, we don't advocate for, we can't legally advocate for anybody for city council. But I personally strongly advocate for Justin Cummings, even though he's quite a disappointment in so many other ways. When he comes out on this article here and says exactly the right thing, asks the right questions. You know,
but doesn't follow up on them. That's his problem.
Well, yeah, because he's a politician. We haven't seen too many people. You know, does Sandy Brown though? Does Sandy Brown?
No, she doesn't have
this issue.
They're both pretty horrible in my view.
She really, you know. But here's the problem: Sandy Brown does not. We can't expect her to be this maverick hero that we need because she has no community behind her. We're all at cross purposes behind her.
Are you only doing this, Brent, because you have community behind you? I don't think so. I think you're doing this because it's a principle with you.
I'm not a politician. I do have community behind me.
You do, but you're not doing it because you have community.
No. Well, that's a good. You make a good point. But I think for her to be effective, it's not effective to be the one versus seven or two on a good day. Versus five. Is she going to be the Posner vote all the time? She has to find ways to. Now I'm talking about what her role is, but I don't fucking know.
See, my response to that is certainly you're right about votes, and certainly you're right about politicians needing to get alliances in order to presumably get things done, if that means a majority vote. But there are some things even an individual council member can do, particularly, for example, regarding the really key people in the city who are not the city council, but the staff and the city manager. She could be making demands of the staff that they would be rejecting, and it would be exposed to the community what they're doing. I asked her to do this 4 years ago. She agreed, and then she didn't do it. And I kept saying, "Come on, Sandy, you agreed to do it." And she said, "Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot, or I wasn't feeling well, or I'll get to it. Call me up. We'll talk some more."
She has a day job. She teaches right at San Jose.
Could be. I'm not familiar with her.
She had a family issues. She had to go travel for those. She does have,
I wrote her up the staff requests, and I said, all you have to do is forward this under your name. And it doesn't look like I wrote it necessarily. You know, it's just straightforward. It was things like how come the city signs downtown that the merchants put up are allowed, whereas they're suddenly going after people. This was in the boxes era that they're now going back to, the vending boxes. You know, you can't have a sign. You can't be there for more than an hour. These signs are up all day, and they violate the city's permit laws, the commercial signs that they have. Can you please, you know, ask that question of the city manager and or of the staff involved, the planning department, whoever's dealing with it? I mean, a series of questions like that could simply be asked and start establishing a record of the city's staff essentially either disregarding, or maybe you'll get somewhere. Maybe they'll change their policy in some small way. And I think the only thing that Sandy Brown has done that is positive that I've seen, although I like her personally, I've got nothing really against her, is that she has generally, when you attempt to talk at city council on a consent agenda item and you request the item be pulled from the agenda, she hasn't kept her word on that completely. I've said, will you agree whenever an individual member of the public wants a consent agenda item, regardless of your view of that item, will you pull it?
Nice.
And she said, sure, I agree to that. And I said, good. But, of course, she's only done that half the time.
City council is not – interacting with the city council has been totally upended by the pandemic and the Zoom. So a lot of us – it just feels daunting to go to their website or whatever, however you want to do this. It's really just emailing is what we're talking about here and making a request. But, I mean, interacting – we used to just line up and speak our minds.
Well, presumably that's going to happen again. They say they're opening it up next meeting.
Do you have to go to the bathroom?
I know, but let's take a break.
Thanks.
The closest to that was Drew Glover. That was the closest.
Yeah, but the problem with Drew Glover is he made all of those things his plan. You know what I mean? We wanted to talk to him about transitional camps, and he decided to make it part of his campaign. He put on the map all kinds of ridiculous city properties that would never host a camp, and then made it, you know, he really wanted to own things and be, you know, and I get that that was his.
But don't all these council members do that generally? I mean, I don't know. I'm not.
No. Before that, I mean, right after that, City O. That's why I really think it's tragic, because Susie O'Hara and Megan Bunch and Lee Butler really did a solid send of the transitional camp concept. She went out of town, visited some up in Portland, came back, he did some research, allowed me to present, and had a really good package that the city council voted unanimously on. And then the following week, because of pushback from the community, because they put a big map up, if you recall that, like they always do, and then there were all these neighborhoods saying, hell no, we won't go. And they voted against it in favor of the parking lot 24 safe parking that then finally Friends of
Depot Park
put the kibosh on the whole thing. And that was it. It hasn't been heard of a transitional cap until their fake out over here. What we really need, though, is what I think is, like, Santa Cruz Cares is kind of indicated, but it looks like Joy Schindeldecker is going to run for city council now or something.
I've heard rumors of that.
I just saw that one of her, she's got a Facebook page or a Instagram that says Joy Schindeldecker 2022.
Oh, really?
Okay. Which I think, but for me, I find it problematic. Because, you know, while it's good that, it looks like when people do that, it looks like Drew Glover. All the behaviors leading up to that were functionary, were performative, to because she's going to be doing this. Like the kind of weak sauce sanitation for the people. Doing kind of piecemeal cleanups and really just, but not real programs.
And apologies for cutting Brent off in mid-sentence, but we will get back to him in a moment.
Play at the playground, to do things I like so much. Run with my friends, play make-believe, swing on the swings and such. This morning I went to the playground, and bullies were guarding the swings. They knocked over the slide, dumped out the sandbox, took away all of our things. This playground is run by bullies, and they're all so big and mean. But this playground was made for all of us, and we're gonna change this scene. All of us were scared of the bullies. They were so big and we were so small. Till somebody said if we organized, we could be 10 feet tall. We stood on each other's shoulders, put blankets over our heads. We looked like monsters and we roared like lions, and those bullies ran home and hid under their beds. This playground was run by bullies, and they're all so big and mean. But this playground was made for all of us, and we're gonna change this scene. Well, we got that playground back, but then we looked across the street, saw the sewage plant belching out smoke, poisoning the ground under our feet, giving us all asthma, and the hour is getting late. So we marched across the way, and we blocked that factory gate. 'Cause this world is run by bullies, and they're all so big and mean. But this world was made for all of us, and we're gonna change this scene. This world is run by bullies, and they're all so big and mean. But this world was made for all of us, we're gonna change this scene.
And that was another one by Rovix. Apparently he did these for some children's videos, I think. but I'm not quite sure what they're called. Nonetheless, enjoy them if you can. And before you get another one, let's go back to more serious talk with Brent Adams.
Kind of piecemeal cleanups and really just get, but not real programs to clean up. Not real porta potty analysis and cleanup. Not real garbage programs like we had back here with this encampment. And then Santa Cruz Cares, where it pretends it's a community group, but really it's just a very few people with the talking points. I like how they survey the community, but then when it's so what's missing is a real coalition of the people, a real conversation that you can be included in, and Kara Polamus, how do you ever say her name, could be a part of. And we can all be a part of it. Keith can be a part of it when he wants to. But really it's allowing, you've seen me do this before, the poles to kind of, instead of pulling apart, the center pulls them in, because most of us aren't represented by you. Most people in Santa Cruz aren't represented by you or I. What are their points of view? We've activist them to death, and they're silent on the issue. Most people are big D or somewhat liberal progressive in Santa Cruz. I would say most. The majority, meaning 50% or more.
Even those who are Carol Polamus.
Yes, right.
Even those who...
And they would prefer... See, the thing is, when Housing Matters... or the 180-20-20 or whoever is doing it, or the county... programs us to death. They tell us the way that what the world is like, and we don't have a voice ourselves saying, "Why are we spending all this money year after year on housing when there is no housing? Where's all this money going?"
Right.
Jerry Leonard once said it cost almost $1 million to house.
Jeremy Leonard.
Yeah. Susan Kuhn. Was that her name? Sarah Kuhn.
Mm-hmm.
Because it took several years and all that effort, a whole program, and going after all the, you know, she was denied over and over and over and over and over for housing until she finally got one and only was in there for 6 months and then back to the street. And that's the big story. Most people who are in permanent supported housing, the support goes away after a year, and then they end up back on the street. So there's nobody talking about this. So the question is, people between the poles of kick them out or let them camp in wherever they want to is a huge conversation that hasn't never happened. What would the most of Santa Cruz moderates be willing to tolerate? Barring we're saying we're also putting people on the pathway to housing, we have to begin to start saying yes, and we have to deal with the people who are out here now. The problem is the city's allowed these large camps to get so big and so dangerous and so crime-oriented. My reflection is more people are doing fentanyl than ever needed to do it. People took their first hit or were forced with a hot needle to take their first hit of heroin in these camps that should never have been in these camps, because the city created a space for all this shit to go down.
It's interesting on what you were saying earlier. I can't really comment on what you're saying there because I don't have good information on it myself. Although I talked to a guy at the town clock today who was enraged about, why aren't they cleaning up this Benchlands camp? He was sort of like a homeless guy. And a lot of people feel that way about that. A number of people I've talked to. But interesting enough, in terms of, I find that sometimes it's true what you say, the activists running for city council, I've often told them this in the past, don't give up your activism. That you're much more valuable in the community doing what you do. But somebody like Glover, he was doing, as far as I'm concerned, was puff piece activism. He was doing this, you know, People's Party, whatever. What was it?
Project Pollination
or some such thing.
Yeah.
I mean, anyway, it's a community sort of feel good.
It was a quarterly festival.
Yeah.
You and I know there's always been festivals in the park, much better than the one he was throwing. And why is that social. It's not, that was not even a thing.
Well, I'm always glad that people get together.
And then the people's poor people's movement. He brought that into Santa Cruz. That it was, you know,
did nothing around racism, for example. That's always pissed me off about, you know.
What's true is he was largely performative and doing things, and we knew what he was. His eye was on city council.
But once he got on the city council, he started. He would hold weekly meetings where he would actually pay attention to the people's proposals that came there. Now maybe he made them his own, as he said. Although I didn't really. I regarded that as simply what city council members do. But provided they do pick up the specifics and raise them at city council, I regard that as novel, to say the least.
Okay, I agree.
You know, and so that was something.
Chris Cohen was silent on that whole thing. In fact, I've been very dissatisfied with him. We're not talking about him as a leader or leadership.
No,
he really just. Did what Chip was afraid he was going to do this time around. Use that activist. He's an activist city council person. Rather than to build movements and build lead us in a direction that can transform things, he just used his seat as kind of a protest device. You know, the minority report and everything like that. But the problem is we as a community are missing. We can't. Imagine Drew Glover or Chris Krohn or Sandy Brown or these people or Joy Schindeldecker is going to lead us out. We need to remember our true power is in authentic grassroots activism, which was actually meeting, getting together. Like here we are, largely the shiny thing is happening. It's going to eclipse this, which is people are going to be focusing on food, not bombs, which is designed to piss the city off. It's the city just playing into their hand over and over, and they play this game back and forth with each other.
People.
Sure, while feeding each other people, but limiting information to services. He doesn't allow homeless services list to be posted there or even handed. He's got a table of information. There's nothing for people who sleep outside on that table. It's an activist pursuit. He says it over and over. This is not a social service organization. This is a protest movement. You know, masquerading as a food program. But so they do serve people food. People, I'm happy to be.
It's also a space where people can come for 3 hours a day, that is much more has more freedom and also more, I think, more security than other places.
Security?
Well, in the sense that, let's say, you're concerned about safety in the benchlands, and then of course there's the reality of safety down.
Because they have to sweep it and be gone every day after. You know, again. Like, I think we really need a conversation about what an authentic food program would be. That Food Not Bombs is kind of like the lowest common denominator. It's not appropriate, in my opinion, in a lot of ways. Why aren't we demanding more? We would seek a supercharged what do we call it? Holy Cross Soup Kitchen.
Peter Kuroda's Soup Kitchen.
Yeah. We need something like that, only much better. 7 days a week, a cafeteria type thing where people can go off the street and hang out. Right now, it's just a sack lunch that they have to walk away, and they don't get to stay there anymore.
Well, also, there's all kinds of differences between Kuroda's Soup Kitchen or any institutional soup kitchen that's indoors, which usually it's not run by homeless people. For instance, one thing about Food Not Bombs is it does pull in homeless folks.
Well, that's because he pockets all of the money. And it's all volunteer. Is it a nonprofit or is it not? It's shady, shady bookwork there.
Are you suggesting he profits off of it?
Oh yeah. So he has a website. If you go to foodnotbombs.org or .net or whatever, people from all over the country give money to that, and it goes into his personal bank account. He says all over the map it's not a charity. He even says it all of his nonprofit. But when you go to the donation page, it says it's a charity. It's a 501c3. But you go to IRS, it was pulled in 2019. So people think they're giving to a charity. They're not. It goes into his personal bank account. Even if you're in Baltimore and you want to give he's clear to not claim that he doesn't have responsibility for any of the other chapters, other than they can take some of the PDF artwork. And it says, set up in the most busy intersection of your town. Don't ask permission. You know, there's a cleaning protocol, and we're serving vegan food, and that's all it says.
Yeah, so are you suggesting that he's corruptly using the money for personal use?
Well, what is he? The food is largely donated. He gets a lot of money from Paul and Lee. I'm sorry, Paul Lee and Herb Schmidt. So I'm just So it's a little dodgy for one nonprofit focusing on homelessness to indicate another one, but I give to that program, and I'm concerned that it's not a nonprofit. It's wishy-washy.
What would you be looking for to either persuade you that you are correct in your suspicions or that you are not?
Well, it's as a protest movement, as an anarchist, I know he could give a shit about taxation and about authenticity. So I think he's just gleaning all the money. I know because I run a nonprofit, and I know the number of $20 bills that flow into this nonprofit to help me keep the lights on. And I can only imagine how much money Food Not Bombs gets. But he's not hiring a single person. A few of them get money. But largely, he doesn't have to pay for space other than the kitchen.
Which is $4,000 a month.
Yeah, but beyond that, it's a little stunning that...
What would you want to do, though?
Well, no, I think it should be more authentic. We need, for the people who suffer sleeping outside, we need an authentic food program.
But for those who are wondering if you're accurate in your characterization of Food Not Bombs and who feel you're just iron critic, you know, what kind of evidence are you looking for? What kind of auditing are you seeking?
All I'm saying is, why does he say it's not a charity? But you go to the donation page, and it says it's a charity. It says it's a 501c3 nonprofit.
I'll ask him in an audio interview.
Then you go to the IRS page, and it's clearly not. So that's super fishy. As anybody running a nonprofit, here's the frightening thing for him. He's playing with fire because they're going to come after him. I don't want them to come after him. I want to see an integrity-based food program, an integrity-based nonprofit. I would like to see Food Not Bombs have some integrity with the people who give them money to, so that he can continue serving food in public spaces. Yeah.
But again, what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to get you to say, well, what I want to make sure that, to test my theory, to prove that this is, that there is a funding that's being improperly used, or perhaps it's now being properly used, what would you recommend a researcher do to determine this? Or what would you like Keith McHenry to do?
I think if he's saying it's not a nonprofit, not a charity, then he should change the donation page. He should also, if he's just receiving the money in Santa Cruz, he should change the name of that website to Santa Cruz Food Not Bombs, not foodnotbombs.org. So people all over the world give to that money, and it just goes to one guy in Santa Cruz. So it doesn't. And the implication is when you give that money, it goes to the organization that serves food all over the all the world.
These are suggestions you have for changing that might set things more straight as far as you're concerned. But what about your concern that this money is being corruptly used? How would you determine whether this was true or not?
I don't know. I'm just saying it's fishy. So I don't know how the money's being used. I just know it goes to his bank account, and it's not a nonprofit bank account. It's not a. I have my own personal bank account. I don't receive funds for the nonprofit into that account. Warming Center has its own bank account, and that has to be strictly accounted for. And that accounting has to be made public. So if he says over and over in public and in news organizations and news that we are not a charity. Then you go to the donation, it says we are a charity. I'm just saying that's super fishy. Where does the money go to? The bank account assigned to Keith McHenry, not Food Not Bombs.
I will raise the issue and see what the man has to say in public.
And I'm not interested in him getting into trouble. We always orient to that organization as, oh, at least they're serving food. Oh, you know, that should give them this great pass. You know what? If that was... Take back Santa Cruz for serving food, we'd be all over that shit. For some reason on the left, we don't care about integrity. We don't care about authenticity. We don't hold ourselves and do really good programs out here. We suck at it, and what we are is the protest activist community, not the service organization community. So I would like to see us do a little bit better.
Too much there, Brent.
No.
Anything you want to conclude with?
No. I encourage people to either look at Footbridge Services, Warming Center Program, warmingcenterprogram@.com and Warming Center Program @gmail. We Are Santa Cruz. It's a reigniting of the Santa Cruz Coalition on Homelessness to talk about this conversation that we need to have to build collective will so that the city council will finally orient towards its people rather than doing whatever the fuck it wants.
I have great sympathy and very little hope for you, hombre.
Yeah. And usually just getting that together is too much for me to muster anyway, so we'll see how
you're doing something else. It's just like I criticize McHenry for not doing the Union of the Homeless because, you know, but he's...
Where's Alicia these days?
Alicia's finally gotten into housing, and she's still doing two jobs over the hill and still taking care of three kids. But and she's no longer living in her van, though, so that's something.
Okay. All right. I'm just wondering if she's still active.
She's kind of active. I mean, she came in on the oral communication discussions of the Public Meetings Act, and I'll be playing some of that stuff on Sunday on my show, I hope. Not as active as I want Seneca's Union to be, but they need somebody else to be running the whole thing because... It's too much for people who are trying to do two and three things. So maybe that's always the case. I don't know. I mean, you find trouble doing two or three things, even though you do a lot of many things involved with this particular job. If you also want to set up a new union of homeless coalition.
We're starting a casework program. But I do want to begin hosting these community meetings called We Are Santa Cruz.
The first meeting will be?
We don't know. We already had a precursor, but this whole city council shit kind of shortchanged it. They got the ball rolling so fast that we have no real input, and it has no indication that they care about the people's point of view.
Well, we knew that to begin with.
Yeah. But who cares about this? We still have... plenty of time to talk about what Santa Cruz. So, as these large buildings are coming, we don't really have a story about who we are anymore. We hate each other in Santa Cruz. Meaning, we hate those on the other side of the political pole, and they hate us. And that's the only story. And that's very few people, actually, in my opinion. There are only 100 of us over here, and probably only 100 of them over there. So, what about the other 50,000 people?
And we will leave it at that. And thank you, Brent, for taking time.
Sure, thank you.
Then we'll move on to other material. I went outside one day and a man was standing there. He had a great big beard and lots of hair. He said, "Won't you come down to the shore and join my jolly crew? We'll wander around the world beneath the skies of blue. We'll sail upon the seven seas, travel near and far. Take from the rich and give to the poor and say, har, 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 har." We'll go out on the ocean, and when the coast is clear, we'll eat birthday cake each day of the year. We'll land on a little island, then we'll form a choir, blow on whistles and kazoos, and dance around a fire. We'll sail upon the seven seas, travel near and far. Take from the rich and give to the poor, and say, har, 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 har. See the Navy, we will shout with pride. We are scary, hairy pirates, so you better run and hide. We'll stamp our feet upon the floor and our peg legs too. We'll take your stolen treasure, 'cause that's what pirates do. We'll sail upon the seven seas, travel near and far. Take from the rich and give to the poor and say, har, 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 har. We'll sail upon the seven seas, travel near and far. Take from the rich and give to the poor and say, har, 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 har.
Reminiscent of glory days with pirate radio, when we actually were pirate radio. Well, here's a story from the San Jose Mercury News from March 8th. Homeless housing operation in limbo. Nonprofit says townhomes are ready, but city obstacles remain. By Marissa Kendall. Four new townhouses in East Oakland sit ready and waiting to house homeless families. But despite the thousands of people sleeping outside on the streets, city officials have yet to let anyone move in. The developer, a grassroots nonprofit organization called Poor Magazine, says the homes on MacArthur Boulevard have been finished for about a year, but they're navigating a gauntlet of code enforcement and permitting hurdles. It's taken months and tens of thousands of dollars to address the city's lengthy list of requirements, from adding three parking spaces, Poor Magazine says residents likely wouldn't use, to painting the vents and the roof. Now, if the project doesn't secure an occupancy permit by today, and that would have been a month and a half ago, the nonprofit will be on the hook for $40,000 in fees. Developers all over the Bay Area have long complained of nitpicky code requirements and expensive building fees, but Lisa Gray Garcia, co-founder of Poor Magazine, says Oakland's rules make it all but impossible for small nonprofits without code expertise or deep pockets to build the affordable housing the city so desperately needs. To call attention to the fact, she and dozens of other activists barged into the city's planning and building department Tuesday, pitched tents, and demanded the city allow their project to open. We have people on the street in this city, and they still refuse to open four beautiful multifamily townhouses, said Gray Garcia, who goes by the name Tiny Garcia, who used to be homeless herself, planned to sleep in a tent in Frank Ogawa Plaza until the city grants the occupancy permit. Neither city spokeswoman Karen Boyd nor the city's planning and development responded to requests for comment. Poor Magazine, which also runs an aid organization, youth newspaper, school, and radio station, has been working on the MacArthur Boulevard project for more than 10 years. Gray Garcia and her team raised hundreds of thousands of dollars in piecemeal donations to buy the property and build the townhouses, which will house between 8 and 12 homeless people rent-free. The money comes from Poor Magazine's Solidarity Family, a group of dozens of people who donate their time, skills, and money, but the nonprofit eventually hopes to open a cafe that will help pay for the property's ongoing costs. They call the project Homefulness. And Tiny was a colleague of the former editor of Street Spirit, Terry Messman. But the group has run into obstacle after obstacle. The city doesn't answer calls or emails asking questions about the permitting requirements, leaving Poor Magazine to interpret complicated city ordinances on its own, says Iris Starr, who used to work for the Planning and Building Department and now volunteers her time to help Poor Magazine. It's impossible, she said. Last summer, the team found out the city requires developers to include parking with new housing based on the project's size and zoning. For the MacArthur building, that meant three spaces, which Gray Garcia said was pointless because most of the low-income residents won't have cars. The nonprofit raised more money and finished the parking spaces in January. It cost $34,000 to level the ground, pour the concrete, and move a utility box that was in the way, Gray Garcia said. That wasn't the end of it. Each subsequent city inspection pointed out something else. Poor Magazine had to fix, Gray Garcia said. They'd fix it, and then the city would come up with something else, she said. The city's most recent notice from February 18th said the group needed to cover a cable in the attic, but the inspector also verbally told them that they needed to paint the vents on the roof, cover some pipes outside, and add a curb to the shower to comply with city building codes, said Mutiato Silencio, one of the project leaders. The delay means Poor Magazine likely will be on the hook for $40,000 in impact fees. City officials issued Poor Magazine's building permit in May 2016 and exempted the group from those fees as long as they finished construction and secured an occupancy permit, which authorizes people to move in, within 3 years. The city granted the group an extension which expired March 2nd. Ironically, the bulk of the $40,000 bill would go toward helping the city build affordable housing. Poor Magazine has purchased a second property a few blocks down MacArthur where the group plans to build 14 accessory dwellings units as homeless housing. On Tuesday, Gray Garcia and her team poured into the lobby of the city's planning and building department, pitched their tents, and after a brief scuffle with security guards, acted out a skit depicting a homeless encampment sweep. Chants of free homefulness rang out as a handful of city employees looked on. Juju Angeles, 38, has been waiting for months to move into one of the homefulness townhouses. Angeles is trained as a midwife and is assisting in deliveries while working on getting licensed in California, but she's not earning enough to afford a Bay Area apartment. She's been couch surfing for the past year while her 14-year-old daughter stays with Angeles' mother. To Angeles, homefulness is an opportunity to have a stable home with her daughter and pursue her dream of delivering babies to low-income mothers without having the burden of rent hanging over their head. Waiting for that to happen has been hard. "It's very emotional," she said. "You feel like you can't provide for your daughter, so it doesn't feel good." And that's Homeless Housing Operation in Limbo. Nonprofits as townhomes are ready, but city obstacles remain. And that's in the Santa Fe Mercury News, March 9th, 2022. And here's our other dark story. For those of us who are concerned with press freedom and remember Julian Assange as a hero, it's a story from the website The Dissenter, dated April 20th, appropriately enough. That's Hitler's mother's birthing day, or his birthday, if you will. Dark day for press freedom. British court orders Assange extradition. A British magistrate's court ordered the extradition of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange to the United States and sent the request for his extradition to Home Office Secretary Priti Patel for approval. The order came a little more than a month after the Supreme Court of the United Kingdom refused to hear Assange's appeal. In December, the UK High Court of Justice granted the US government's appeal and overturned a district court decision that spared Assange. Chief Magistrate Senior District Judge Paul Goldspring contended that he was duty-bound to send the extradition request to Patel. Goldspring also told Assange he had a right to appeal if the Home Office approved the extradition before issuing the order. Mark Summers, QC, an attorney for Assange, asserted there were fresh developments in the case and bemoaned the fact that the defense was not permitted at this stage to raise this evidence, according to Computer Weekly's Bill Goodwin. Assange's legal team has until May 18th to submit evidence to the Home Office and argue why the department should block the extradition request. In 2 months, Patel is expected to make a decision. If approved by Patel, attorneys for Assange may request permission to appeal to the British High Court of Justice. His attorneys may appeal the decision of the district judge to send the case to the Home Office for approval and may also appeal the Home Office's secretary's order. My note, aside from the story, is it looks to me like the fix is pretty much in, although I'm no expert in British law or this particular case, except that it's such an obvious case of press freedom, where Assange is hated and pursued by U.S. government agencies across the world, essentially for revealing things like the collateral murder in Iraq and the, I guess in 2007, when U.S. pilots mowed down with glee civilians on the ground. And it was revealed by Manning through WikiLeaks and through Assange. While the defense for Assange objected to District Judge Vanessa Beritzer's ruling on January 4th, 2021, that was over a year ago now, particularly as it related to issues of press freedom, which she completely ignored, they never had an appropriate opportunity to raise their objections. She denied the extradition request after determining it would be, quote, oppressive for mental health reasons. And that's a very genteel way of saying that she pointed out that U.S. prisons were likely to drive him to suicide. His attorneys would likely challenge many of Beritzer's conclusions about Assange if Patel allowed the request. However, Baritzer is no longer a district judge at the Westminster Magistrates Court. Assange is detained at Her Majesty's prison, Belmarsh, pretty grim, notorious prison as far as I've heard. He faces 18 charges brought against him by the U.S. Justice Department, 17 of which are under the Espionage Act. And that's where reporting true facts, which are given to you, but which had been previously confidential, can be used to accuse you of spying, even though you're simply presenting the truth to the general public and not conveying it to the enemy secretly. That's my addition. All the charges relate to documents WikiLeaks released in 2010 and 2011, which were provided by U.S. Army whistleblower Chelsea Manning, as mentioned before. The prosecution makes Assange the first publisher to be charged under the 1917 law. It's cooked up in war hysteria of World War I by Wilson in order to move the country into World War I and protect British interests, in my view. The case has been condemned by virtually all reputable civil liberties, human rights, and press freedom organizations. Patel and the Home Office support an expansion of the official secrets laws in the UK, which Elmazi reports would expand possible imprisonment for leakers, recipients of leaks, and secondary publishers, including journalists, from the current maximum of 2 years to as high as 14 years in prison. The Home Office contends there is no longer much of a difference between espionage and the most serious unauthorized disclosures. That includes what Patel would call onward disclosure. The department retreats journalism as an act capable of, quote, far more serious damage than traditional espionage. Of course, it's damage to what? The reputations and the credibility of the government officials who are engaging in genocidal behaviors. That would be my thought. In the UK, the Office for Security and Counterterrorism is a part of the Home Office. The division is responsible for MI5, Britain's FBI, and anti-terrorism police operations. Operation Pelican, the name for the pressure campaign to force Assange out of the Ecuador embassy in London, was supported by the Home Office. But as declassified UK chief investigator Matt Kennard noted, the Home Office claims it does not hold any records containing details related to the operation, even though 8 officials from the department were involved. This is the attempt to force Assange out of the sanctuary that he had sought in the Ecuadorian embassy for 8 years. Government plan to do that. Prime Minister Boris Johnson. Kennard also reported that Patel was on the advisory council for a right-wing group linked to the CIA called the Henry Jackson Society, which has attacked Assange in the press for over a decade. And so this is the guy who is going to be making a decision on Patel's case, I mean on Assange's case. Prime Minister Boris Johnson and Priti Patel don't extradite Julian to the country that conspired to murder him. Stella Assange declared, or actually he's appealing to the two of them, Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister, and Priti Patel, the judge. Or I guess he's not the judge, he is the Home Office Secretary, Priti Patel is. Stella Assange, his wife, Assange's wife, declared they can stop this nightmare today and return to Julian, return him to his family. They can do the right thing and enforce Article 4 of the U.S.-UK extradition treaty, which prohibits extradition for political offenses. This is a political case, and with the signature of the magistrate, this now passes squarely into the political domain, Stella added. The next 4 weeks will prove crucial in the fight to block extradition and secure the release of Julian Assange, stated Rebecca Vincent, the director of operations and campaigns for Reporters Without Borders. The Home Secretary must act now to protect journalism and adhere to the UK's commitment to media freedom by rejecting the extradition order and releasing Assange. RSF, Reporters Without Borders, a global press freedom organization, launched a Free Assange petition urging supporters to sign on before May 18th, the last day Assange can make any submissions to the Home Office. The National Union for Journalists in the UK renewed their call for his release from Belmarsh prison and for charges to be dropped. Assange defense groups and a coalition of civil liberties, human rights, and press freedom organizations will build on prior work and use the next several weeks to ramp up their campaigning. Their intent will be to make the extradition request a political issue in the UK and throughout Europe. He will remain in detention at Belmarsh until Patel's decision and during any appeal. Guy has taken a lot of shit for passing on information to the rest of us.
Children played in the playground, swinging on swings, didn't hear the sound of the single plane that flew overhead. Third shift workers just going to bed. There was a flash of light, rumbling noise, gone in an instant. Girls and boys, 10,000 mothers were boiling rice. 3,000 prisoners of war were rolling the dice, hoping they'd survive this terrible storm. Each young man in his uniform vanished in the air in the blink of an eye. One moment they lived, and the next they all died. Hiroshima. Hiroshima. And lovers made love to each other, each one of them thinking there might not be another. Living so long with death everywhere, much more than one person alone can bear. There wasn't time for a final kiss. Who could have known it would end like this? Hiroshima. 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 200,000 people were living their lives. Grandparents, children, fathers and wives. Now they're just shadows on the street. Such a quick burst of incredible heat. Now listen to them talk about doing it again. From whence came the souls? Terrible men, Hiroshima. 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 Hiroshima.
And that one was called Hiroshima. You've heard it before if you've been listening to my show regularly. And all these songs, of course, are by David Rovix. And they're part of the House Concert for the Web, which you can find on his davidrovics.com website. And I'll be playing probably one or two more songs, well, at least one more of his. But nuclear weapons are a particularly important thing for us to remember because it's becoming so clear we're so close to the abyss here that it's... It should be frightening. I'm noticing that I'm not frightened, and I think that doesn't mean that I'm more realistically tuned in and a calm appreciator of how everything really is going to turn out okay, because that's not really how I estimate it when I look at it. It's like, though, I'm really numb to what the real situation is, as I'm afraid many of us are. So, the show numbly continues. Here's a story from the Chronicle of a couple weeks ago, April 4th, Rally Seeks Accountability in Police Shooting by Lauren Hernandez. Dozens of people rallied at San Jose City Hall on Friday to demand accountability in the police shooting of a Bay Area student athlete whose attorney said is a hero for disarming a gunman during an early morning fight at a downtown restaurant. I may have read something about this before, but I think it's still an outstanding case, as far as I know. Con Green, that's K-A-U-N Green, was hospitalized with injuries from the March 27th shooting at La Victoria Taqueria. Police said they shot him after he refused their orders to drop the gun, but his supporters say he saved lives and has been unfairly portrayed in police statements. Green is a linebacker at Contra Costa College and has dreams of playing football professionally in the NFL. People in the crowd demanded that police release body camera footage. Police have released only a still photograph showing Green's back turned away from police, holding the gun upward in his left hand in the moments before police shot him. Standing beneath the flags in front of the City Hall Rotunda, community activists led the chants of "Say his name, Con Green. No justice, no police. No racist police, and all lives can't matter until black lives matter." Relatives of people killed by police in recent years passed a microphone and shared their stories. At one point, people in the crowd bowed their heads, closed their eyes, and held a minute of silence for Green. "In this minute of silence, I want you to imagine the kind of young man Con Green is," said Kiana Simons, who organized the rally through her nonprofit Hero Tent, which stands for Human Empowerment, Radical Optimism. "He is someone who is brave enough to risk his own well-being and safety to protect others. He is the captain of his college football team. He is driven and thoughtful, and he does not deserve to be shot four times by the police." Green's attorney, Adante Pointer, said the student athlete wrested the firearm from Brian Carter, 30, who pulled it out during a fight. Police have said officers responding to the fight did not know whether the incident was related to a nearby homicide. Pointer said a video he has reviewed does not appear to show police ordering Green to drop the gun, saying it appears the officer opened fire within seconds of his client emerging from the restaurant. Kiaran L., 20, who identified herself as the niece of Demetrius Stanley, a man shot and killed by an undercover plainclothes San Jose police officer in 2021, said it is difficult to navigate her grief when police continue to shoot people. "The tragedies of others just keep expanding and growing, and things just keep getting worse and building, and it doesn't seem like things are getting better." That's because they aren't, of course. She said as she wrote in chalk the names of people killed by San Jose police, "I believe justice is possible, but not justice in the current state." Saeed Khan, a Santa Clara County public defender running for district attorney, said institutions meant to protect the community failed to do so. He said the DA's office has not prosecuted police officers who have killed people. "When someone is fortunate enough to survive a police bullet, they don't get services, they don't get trauma-informed care, they get handcuffs, they get put in a jail cell, they get prosecuted, they get a felony conviction, they get their name dragged through the mud, and their reputation slandered," Khan told the crowd. And that's a brief story in the Chronicle. Rally seeks accountability in police shooting. That's April 4th. There's a later story on April 8th in the East Bay Times online. San Jose attorneys sue city over police shooting of man who disarmed gunman in taqueria fight. Con Green spoke publicly for the first time since an officer shot him four times. Con Green is suing the city of San Jose, saying he was wrongly shot by police and later criminalized after a taqueria brawl during which he disarmed a man he feared might shoot him and his friends. Speaking publicly for the first time since being shot four times by a police officer in the early morning hours of March 27th in the doorway of a La Victoria restaurant near San Jose State University, the former high school football star vowed to pursue justice and bounce back from his injuries to continue his college playing career. In all honesty, I'm in pain. I'm hurting inside and out, the 20-year-old Oakland resident said during a Zoom press conference Thursday morning, along with his team of attorneys, wearing what appeared to be a wrapper cast on his left arm. They treated me like a criminal, even though I saved my friend's life. I never thought I would be in this position, never did anything to put myself in this position. It's still surreal to me. It just hurts to know I can't play football this year, but I'm going to try my hardest to make a comeback. His attorneys, Adante Pointer, Patrick Bulna, and Angel Alexander, alleged police gave Green no time to follow their orders to drop the gun in the seconds between his emergence from the restaurant, his back facing officers, and when he was shot. That contention is the crux of a federal civil rights and excessive force lawsuit they filed Thursday against the city of San Jose and the yet-to-be-named officer, still keeping it under wraps, eh, who shot Green. My client, Mr. Green, was not the person who brought that gun to the restaurant that night, was not the person endangering everyone's lives, Pointer said. Instead, he was a person who was the victim, a victim-turned-hero who was victimized again by the San Jose Police Department. Green's attorneys also complained how Green was handcuffed to his hospital bed, even after it was clear he did not bring the gun to the restaurant, and noted that police said last week there were no plans to arrest or charge him. Green is a former McClyman's High School star quarterback who was attending Contra Costa College and fielding college scholarship offers to play linebacker and defensive end. San Jose police declined comment on the lawsuit, citing that it is pending litigation, and the city attorney's office also declined comment on similar grounds. In a news conference last week, San Jose Police Chief Anthony Mata defended his police officers, saying Green refused orders to drop the handgun he was holding. It was impossible in the moment for officers to know his role. He added that the five officers on the steps leading to the eatery were working the scene of a fatal shooting nearby and were grappling with the possibility the shooter might be there. The officers knew that a homicide with a firearm had just occurred and that the suspect with the firearm had fled and could be in the immediate area. The officer knew that the person coming out of the restaurant was holding a gun and pointed it at others, Mata said last week. The officer did not know he brought the gun to the restaurant. Police released excerpts of security camera footage showing the brawl unfolding, and a video recorded by a witness shows the five officers walking up the restaurant steps with guns drawn, followed soon by a man dressed in a black shirt backing out the front door, holding what appears to be a handgun in his left hand. As the man, since identified as Green, starts to turn around to face them, one of the officers opened fire. Pointer and his firm tell a different story, saying the whole sequence began as Green and his friends were waiting for their food when a man picked a fight with Green. The attorney said the unknown man punched Green in the face and the two wrestled to the ground. The attorneys say someone with the man Green was fighting pointed a handgun at Green's head, prompting Green to wrest away the gun and fend off their attempts to take it back. They added that Green was walking backward toward the front door and eluding the grasps of his attackers with the handgun pointed up in the air when he encountered the officers outside. Within mere seconds of arriving on the scene and without giving any sort of reasonable warning or opportunity to comprehend and comply with any orders, a San Jose police officer shot Khan four times just after he had heroically protected himself and everyone in the restaurant from the gunman, the lawsuit reads. Green said Thursday, "The only thing that was on my mind was getting out of there safely, just to go home. I didn't want anything bad to happen." He was hit twice in the left arm, once in his left knee, and once in his abdomen. His lawsuit, which seeks unspecified damages, also states that Green's dream of playing Division I football and being drafted into the National Football League are in jeopardy. Green recalled being in an ambulance and trying to reach his parents. Green's mother, Kalia Thompson, and his father, Antoine Green, described frantically trying to find out where their son was, knowing only that he was in San Jose to attend a football scrimmage at the university, but getting no answers. They said they didn't get to see their wounded son until Tuesday, more than 48 hours later. "That was one of the worst days of our lives, not knowing where your child is, not understanding what's going on," Antoine Green said. "They treated us unfairly and they broke our hearts. They broke our son's heart. No one should have to hear from social media or other sources that their son has been shot down and is in a hospital." Thompson said, "We're praying for justice for my son." The attorneys also took issue with how no other officer opened fire. At the news conference last week, Assistant Chief Paul Joseph said each officer makes an individual assessment on whether to fire their weapon. Joseph said a factor for the officer who did shoot, a four-year member of the San Jose PD who has not been publicly identified, was being at the front of the formation and closest to Green in the handgun. The officer who shot Green has been placed on administrative leave while the police department and Santa Clara County DA's office investigate the shooting. Alexander and the legal team are calling for the unedited release of security videos and officer body camera footage from the fight and shooting. Mata said the police department plans to comply with the state law compelling the release of such videos within 45 days of a critical incident. "We demand transparency, we demand accountability," Alexander said, "and we demand justice for Mr. Green and his family." And this is a story from the East Bay Times of April 21st, Thursday. So that's today's e-edition. Unless it's an earlier story in a... No, it's in April. It was updated April 8th. So along the side, there are some additional stories. Northern California CHP officer shoots, kills man after getting dragged by vehicle. San Leandro ex-officer hit with $10 million lawsuit over fatal shooting that got him charged with manslaughter. Autopsy, motorist Leoya shot by officer in back of the head. Man with weapon fatally shot by California police had BB gun. And again, this is a reason to consider defunding police departments and funding some other kind of agencies, or in some fundamental way recognizing that this is situation is not changing in spite of all the publicity given to police murders in the last 2 years. Maybe time for another musical break.
The fifth month of the year, on the 1st of May, known around the world as International Workers' Day, you'll still see people marching in.